As we get into chapters 38 and 39, if you have read it, you might wonder some things about timing. And it might sound like what happens in chapters 38 and 39, in fact, happens before what we read about last week. And if you think it sounds like that, it's probably because that's what it is. And we know from reading other parts of Isaiah that chronology is not the main goal. It's not just, let me tell you the straight history facts. This is a book of theology. It's telling us about God and God's work among the people. And so when it makes more sense to arrange some things thematically, then Isaiah is going to do that. We don't know, for instance, what's going on with the first five chapters when he gets his calling in chapter 6. Well, when did those first things happen? Maybe before, maybe after. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how it is arranged. It seems today, as we turn our attention to Babylon, it seems as though Isaiah may have arranged these things to help pivot us toward Babylon, who is going to be the major villain in the next part of the book. So we're going to pivot things towards Babylon because they are on the horizon, okay? And what we'll see in these chapters, we get a bad report about Hezekiah's health. And he responds with a pretty marvelous prayer, kind of interesting though. We'll look at that, what he says, and God's response to that. But then the Hezekiah in chapter 38 makes a turn, and the Hezekiah in chapter 39 seems quite different. This guy is a complicated character. So we're going to look at this trust and yielding, and yet we're going to see even as we look ahead that it's not going to be as great as we might think. Chapter 38, verses 1 through 8. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. The prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to him and said, "This is what the Lord says. Put your house in order, because you're going to die. You will not recover." Well, that's a bad message to get told. Very perfunctory, isn't it? God says, get your affairs in order, you're going to die. And in case you didn't know what that means, let me just be clear, you're not going to recover. Boom. That's it. Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord. "Remember, Lord, how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion and have done what is good in your eyes." And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah. "Go and tell Hezekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of your father David, says. I've heard your prayer and seen your tears. I will add 15 years to your life, and I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria. I will defend this city. This is the Lord's sign to you that the Lord will do what he has promised. I will make the shadow cast by the sun go back the 10 steps it has gone down on the stairway of Ahaz." So the sunlight went back 10 steps it had gone down. Let me call your attention first to Hezekiah's prayer. It's very short. "Remember how I've walked before you and with wholehearted devotion and have done what is good in your eyes." That's all he says. I want you to tell me your response to Hezekiah's prayer. How do you read this prayer? What's he trying to do with these words?
Would it be ask for mercy?
Asking for mercy? We'll get Dennis over here since we've got a mic, and then we'll come over here.
I think he was asking for time so he could do the best he could to save the people.
Okay, he's asking for mercy. He's asking for time.
I think he's negotiating. I think he's wanting. He's wanting something for something.
He is. Okay. There's a Latin phrase for that. Yeah.
To me, he's saying, I fought a good fight. I kept the faith. Now, will you please give me more time?
Okay. Okay, all of you so far hear him asking for something, which is fair. Now, he doesn't say that, does he? It's implied. Some of you hear him asking for that. So that's a fair read, that he's saying, hey, I've done all this good stuff, and the implication is, therefore, I don't deserve to die. Would you do something about this? Fair reading. Does anyone read it differently, where he's not asking for anything? He's buttering up God. We're still here. Let's come over here.
I think he's wanting to finish leading the fight mm-hmm. for the turnaround. It's not that he's personally trying to gain anything, but okay. he wants to see this fight through.
Okay. Josh? Yes.
What did they believe was going to happen to them after they died?
It's a good question. So in the psalmists are going to say things like, can someone praise you from the pit? Do the dead praise you? So at this point, they certainly wouldn't say, I don't think they would say, you go to heaven to be with God forever when you die. I'm not sure they're there yet. They start to get there. If those of you who have been in Alden Bass's Wednesday night class really see how this concept of the afterlife begins to flourish. But right now, I'm not sure he thinks that.
So if he was not asking to live longer, is it possible he was asking for something in the afterlife?
Could be. Could be.
Josh, I just, as a matter of curiosity, do we have any idea of the age of Hezekiah at this time?
I'm sure we do. I don't know. Somebody in here probably can get a good read on that. 54. Google. Oh, Dr. Google? Good. Thank you. Good. So there is a sense here. He does not... come out and say it. There is a sense where many of you are reading him saying, this isn't fair. I've done well. I've been faithful. So can we do something about this? Could be that. When I talked to our teachers on Wednesday night as we were going through this lesson, others of them just heard Hezekiah sort of going over his life and hoping that he had in fact lived well and hoping that God would affirm that and not necessarily asking for anything to be done. Regardless of what Hezekiah's intent is, God's response is to extend his life. So whether Hezekiah intended to ask for this or not, and it's a fair read to assume he did, but maybe he didn't, God's response, it says, I've heard your prayer, so it seems to be a response to that. I'm going to give you 15 years, and I'm going to deliver you and this city from Assyria. Pretty great for Hezekiah. 15 more years. And he gives them a sign. We could talk more about what this sign is. We won't. But he's going to give them a sign. It has to do with his father Ahaz. And to say things are going to be different. Okay? So that is a very quick... you're going to die, and he says, I think it's too early, I've been faithful, and God says, here's 15 more years, okay? What we get next is a very, I think a very profound piece of theology from Hezekiah. So this happens after his illness and recovery. We're not sure exactly how long, but here's what he says after he gets better. Verse 10, in the prime of my life, must I go through the gates of death and be robbed of the rest of my years? If I said, I will not again see the Lord himself in the land of the living, no longer will I look on my fellow man or be with those who dwell in this world. Like a shepherd's tent, my house has been pulled down and taken from me. Like a weaver, I have rolled up my life, and he has cut me off from the loom. Day and night, you made an end of me. I waited patiently till dawn, but like a lion, he broke all my bones. Day and night, you made an end of me. I cried like a swift or thrush. I moaned like a mourning dove. My eyes grew weak as I looked to the heavens. I am being threatened. Lord, come to my aid. But what can I say? He has spoken to me, and he himself has done this. I will walk humbly all my years because of this anguish of my soul. Lord, by such things people live, and my spirit finds life in them too. You restored me to health and let me live. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. In your love, you kept me from the pit of destruction. You have put all my sins behind your back. For the grave cannot praise you. Death cannot sing your praise. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they praise you as I'm doing today. Parents, tell their children about your faithfulness. The Lord will save me, and we will sing with stringed instruments all the days of our lives in the temple of the Lord. Isaiah had said, prepare a poultice of figs and apply it to the boil, and he will recover. Hezekiah had asked, what will be the sign that I will go up to the temple of the Lord? Those last two verses seem a little bit tacked on at the end and may have happened before this. But really, we're going to talk about the substance of Hezekiah's prayer because it's pretty profound. Because if you notice, he both vividly blames God for the disaster that's happened to him and credits God for the recovery. Do you see that? I mean, look what he says earlier on. He mixes his pronouns here a little bit, but don't get confused. He's talking about God. He broke my bones. He made an end of me. I'm asking God to come to my aid. And then he has done this. Well, what has he done? He's restored my health. He's let me live. This is a very long way to say, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Hezekiah understands that the illness was at least allowed, if not caused by God, and God is the one who can fix it, and in fact, God did. And then you get this hint, we asked about the afterlife. I can't praise you from the grave. Death, the pit, this is where he thinks he's going to end up. If he dies, this is it at this point. So if I die, you've lost one less praiser. So why would you want me to die? This is pretty common motivation when you read lament psalms, and the psalmist feels like he's about to die. And one of his motivations for God to fix things is, hey, dead people don't sing praises to God. But the living praise you. Okay? So, let me stop for a minute. What do you think about this poetic prayer that Hezekiah prays after he is restored to health?
Well, one of the verses that jumped out at me, verse 17, surely it was for my benefit that I suffered this such anguish. In your love, you kept me from the pit of destruction. And the psalmist said something real similar in Psalms 119. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now I obey thy law.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, we wonder about suffering. We have trouble with suffering, and especially, why do good people suffer? Sometimes God is moving us in a different direction, I believe. And sometimes, if we're headed in the wrong direction, some things come our way to maybe like a bridle in our mouth.
That's
to
right.
Turn us around.
Such an important perspective. After the fact, seems willing to acknowledge that the suffering may have been good for him. Here's a little pro tip for all of us who are dealing with people in grief. Probably not say to them in the middle of the grief. Do you know what I mean? So those of us who've had hard things happen and have gotten to a place where we can credit God's good work don't normally figure that out in the middle of the pit. It takes some perspective. When we're in it, really all we're saying is help, help, help. And I think it's reasonable not to expect ourselves or others who are in the middle of the pit and cannot see much in front of us. It's reasonable not to expect to have this perspective right then. Because all you can say in that moment is, this really stinks. But sometimes, later on, when we look back, we can see how God was at work. So all I'm saying is, this is true and this is important, and I bet all of us have experiences where we would say that. It's also true that we don't take this and go to someone who's in the middle of the pit and say, boy, maybe God is working this for good for you. You might get punched in the face. Do you know what I mean? Like that's just not the right timing. That's Job's friends kind of thing. In the pit, people just need to hear that God is still with you. Your friends are still with you. We're going to stick this out. Okay?
There's this interesting chronology over in 2 Chronicles. And I don't know whether you were planning on going over there or not, but let me just read it to you. It says, in those days Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. He prayed to the Lord, who answered him and gave him a miraculous sign. But Hezekiah's heart was proud, and he did not respond to the kindness shown him. Therefore, the Lord's wrath was on him and on Judah and Jerusalem. Then Hezekiah repented of the pride of his heart, as did the people of Jerusalem. Therefore, the Lord's wrath did not come on them during the days of Hezekiah.
Yep.
So it's like you mentioned a second ago, something tacked on at the end.
Yes.
If this is the way it is, then maybe there was considerable time between mm-hmm. his healing.
Yeah.
And he turned away, and then he looked back and repented. And so maybe this is quite a bit later.
Could be, yeah. Okay, so we know the Hezekiah that we talked about in chapter 38. And so that's why it's a little bit shocking to read about this Hezekiah in chapter 39. So, first two verses. At that time, Marduk-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift because he had heard of his illness and recovery. Hezekiah received the envoys gladly and showed them what was in his storehouses, the silver, the gold, the spices, the fine olive oil, his entire armory, and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in his palace or in all his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Well, that's sort of interesting, isn't it? I'm not quite sure what to make of Hezekiah's actions. But I get a bad feeling about this. Do you? It's not typically what you do when someone brings you a get-well gift or a, you know, glad-you're-well gift. Look at all this stuff. Is it boasting? Is it this idea of intimidating? Like, hey, go home and tell them how much stuff I have. It's interesting. But my read on this is negative. That his actions here are bad. I'm wondering if someone in here has maybe a positive read on what he's doing here. Anybody here look at this differently?
I think he may have been, trying to do what God wanted. He's doing this to make sure that there's a desire to take over this area when he's gone.
Okay. Okay.
I kind of take it as a read to look at who I am, look at what I have, but I can share, I can give in order for God to prevail.
Okay.
It was just a show of his prominence in the place where he is.
Okay.
And yet I will give.
Okay, fair enough.
I've always felt that Hezekiah, you know, he started out so well. Mm-hmm. And God gave him those extra 15 years. And in those 15 years, he begat a son who became king, who was the most evil king Israel ever had. And so, you know, when you read about his attitude toward all this stuff, it's like he wasted those 15 years. Mm. He could have left wonderful things and a great belief in God, and
sure.
Instead, he had a son that he totally left to idolatry and all that.
Yep.
So I think he wasted that.
I think so. Okay. Well, let's see how this story ends, and then we're going to talk about some takeaways for us. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and said, "What did those men say, and where did they come from?" "From a distant land," Hezekiah replied. "They came to me from Babylon." The prophet asked, "What did they see in your palace?" "They saw everything in my palace," Hezekiah said. "There's nothing among my," I'm just going to highlight some words here, "my treasures that I did not show them." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your predecessors have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," Hezekiah replied, for he thought, "There will be peace and security in my lifetime." An interesting takeaway from that. So I want to call your attention. Let me go back. This is in 38, verse 4, when the word of the Lord comes to Isaiah and Hezekiah hears it, which is, "You're going to be healed. I'm going to give you 15 more years." Okay? Now look. Here we go. "Now the word of the Lord comes and says, let me tell you what's in store for you. All this stuff that you showed these envoys on the grand tour of what you're calling your palace and all of what you're calling your treasures, they're going to be gone. They'll be carried off to Babylon. Nothing's going to be left. You're going to have some descendants. They're going to be taken away. And they will," I just want to call your attention, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on it, but the process of becoming eunuchs is not pleasant, okay? It's not something you want to hear about your descendants. They will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. That's even worse. And you would think, after hearing verse 7, someone might be devastated to hear that because of how it's going to affect their descendants and their homeland. You would think. But if you were to think that, you would be wrong. Because Hezekiah's takeaway is, good. Things are going to be fine while I'm alive. An interesting conclusion. So here's my question. What is going on with Hezekiah? Someone make some sense of this for us. What do you make of this guy?
Well, he knows his son's corrupt, and he knows that he's going to lead the whole kingdom into idolatry and everything else. And he's saying, so be it. Take him away. You know, let God take care of what he needs to take care of. But he says, I wash my hands of it.
Okay. Yeah, so tell us more about, you think he at this point knows his son is corrupt? Is going to be? Maybe.
I
you think? Fair enough. What else?
Seems like maybe after God gave him that 15 years and even what he had said in his prayer, that there is a deep sense of pride in this man and that he somehow felt that he deserved it, you know, perhaps more than others. And then just as an aside, this he sounds a lot like Congress to me, just putting the burden on our grandchildren for the trillions in debt.
I'm afraid I'm not very kind about this. I think he sounds like somebody who's not very smart.
Okay. Words fitly spoken. I like it.
It just seems that in verses 1 through 2, he's showing everything that is in his storehouses. So that pride thing comes up. And so evidently what had been read in Second Chronicles, this pride. And so it's so easy to fall back into after we've gone through a crisis and God has rescued us and we feel comfortable and good, and then we start looking back about what we've done and maybe in a new setting. And then he hears what the Lord has said, and he does seem to gain a little bit of perspective. The word of the Lord you have spoken is good. In other words, it will be. And so he recognizes that, and he's thankful that in his time there won't be the trouble, but he knows it's coming. So I think he has to live with that.
Danny and somebody over here. Oh, yeah, Mike.
You know, it comes back to what you were saying a while ago. It makes you wonder, does he think when he's dead it's over?
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to where they're not looking for
right
anything further.
I appreciate it. That's right. Yep.
Well, let me read from 2 Chronicles again.
All right, let's go.
But when envoys were sent by the rulers of Babylon to ask him, that's Hezekiah, about the miraculous sign that had occurred in his land, God left him to test him and to know everything that was in his heart. Now, if you put all this together, it kind of looks like this response, him showing everything in his palace, was part of a test.
Mm-hmm.
So God was able to find out everything that was in his heart. And I'm kind of in agreement with these others. It's like, well, I got my 15 years. I don't really much care what happens to everybody else.
Yeah.
So that's why it's good for us not to know the future, right?
That's right. Yes.
I think he was just concerned with his legacy. Mm-hmm. He wanted people to know that he was rich and he had so much, so many things, and that he provided peace and security in his reign.
Mm-hmm.
So history would show that he was a good guy.
Yeah. Yep. We've got some more comments. There we go. I see quick hands and don't always remember.
Well, for me, that kind of kicks back to Hezekiah's prayer and throws a little bit different light on it. Looking back, he says, remember, O Lord, how I walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion and have done what is good in your eyes. So it just throws a little bit different on his core being.
So let's talk about us for a few minutes, okay? I see a Hezekiah in previous chapters who would, in the end, get a pretty good verdict. What I mean is, if we didn't have this chapter, we would have an overall positive view of Hezekiah. And then I see Hezekiah in this chapter, even excluding for a minute other accounts of this, just looking at how Isaiah is portraying Hezekiah on its own. And I see someone who has forgotten. I mean, in chapter 38, he gets told he's going to die. And the Lord grants him a reprieve. And Hezekiah acknowledges that it's God who grants him the reprieve. And look what happens. I don't know exactly when this is, but it's sometime in the next decade or so, if not earlier. I think it's quite a bit earlier. Look how quickly he forgets God. This B is a metaphor for the nation of Israel that we have studied this whole quarter. Look at everything God has done for you, and look at how you have forgotten, and you're chasing every other possibility to help you. You want an alliance with this nation. No, you want an alliance with this nation. No, you want to build up the military. You can do all these things except trust the God who has cared for you. And we are fooling ourselves if we believe that we are immune to that kind of thinking. Because there are seasons in our life when we can give strong testimony to the power of God in our lives. And we can recall specific things for which we are grateful. And then we forget. And I'm telling you, Hezekiah is, in a nutshell, a great warning against forgetting God, because he turns like that. I mean, you read the first 38 chapters and you think, how on earth, I mean, after the army has been killed. Now, I realize this happens later chronologically, but Isaiah is trying to build a case for the God who has kept his people. And here is their leader who seems to forget all that and seems not to care in the end. Pretty good teaching moment for us, isn't it? Isn't it? Because we can forget the work of God in our lives. And that's not to say that every moment is going to be filled with joy and thanksgiving. It is not. But there's a difference between being in the pit, which is pretty normal, and wondering where God is. That's pretty normal. Let's do that all the time. The difference between being there and completely forgetting the work of God and believing in active ways that he no longer cares. That is forgetting. And I don't know exactly what that line is like, but I can tell you that Hezekiah crossed it, and I can tell you I don't want to cross it. I bet I have sometimes in saying, I don't think God is active anymore. And so whatever happens, happens. As long as things are good for me, great. I'm done with this. And Hezekiah, these chapters end on a warning. And we're going to see what happens with Babylon when we get to this in March. I'm wondering if you have any closing comments. I'm going to be finished. We have just a few more minutes if you want them. I'm wondering if you have any closing comments about Isaiah chapters 38 and 39, or really anything in the first 39 chapters.
Josh, you know what's hard for me to grasp is going back to verse 36, where from a military aspect, where king of Assyria, I can't hardly comprehend him waking up a morning and his army is no more. I mean 185,000
yes.
People. That's hard for me to grasp.
What it is.
His mindset, boy, that should put the fear in him.
I bet it was hard for him to grasp too, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. That's right.
What'd they do with all the bodies?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, we've seen lots of things from these chapters, but I hope most importantly we've seen more accurately who God is and what God's relationship is with his people. We can get caught up in all the details of who, what, where, when, and why. And those are important. I like those too. But in the end, this book is about God. And it's about what God does with God's people. And I hope that it convicts us at points and it encourages us at points. Because we see a God who is full of mercy, but he was full of justice. And he does not ignore either one of those things. So, we've got judgment, we got hope. You put those together, you get a full picture of who God is. I hope we have gotten closer to understanding that this quarter together. Thank you very much for your kind attention.